This next session is about action. This next session is about starting to bring together what we should do. And the emphasis is on we should do. You are hopefully had an interesting day informed by some absolutely brilliant interventions from people that have come from all over the world. And now you may go back to your own organizations and you may continue your new jobs or your existing jobs, and you will hopefully be even better informed than you were before, more effective, more productive. But this question is about what we do together. And that's the nature of this conversation. One of the themes that has come up over and over again is about associations, cooperatives. Well, this is a platform. This is a cooperative. This is the opportunity for us to understand how difficult that job is by us showing the sort of leadership about how we collaborate, create more power and more influence together. The Green Economy Coalition, when I took the job a while ago and I was asked, let's create a new economy that works for people and planet, somebody said to me, changing the economy is like re-engineering a plane whilst it's in flight. People's lives depend on it. What you actually need to do is you need to create something that runs alongside, evolve a new alternative, and gradually migrate people across to it, and then try and land that plane. Yeah? And this idea of the informal being in parallel, I get the sense of principles. It's not a panacea. It's not a wonderful place to be, but there are principles of no waste. There are principles of circular. There are principles of being most effective, of labor. Those principles you can see are some of the things that we want the formal economy to start to take more seriously. So there is some really exciting things, and we're going to have two sessions. The first is about action, about what we do, what we've learned today. Now, there's been a little bit of groundhog, I imagine, every single time we had the buzzes and you had the same questions over and over again about what do we need to do on all those different sectors. Maybe there are things that occurred over and over again. Well, hopefully there are, because they will be the things that we can start to agree on that are common to all those sectors. So we're going to start trying to get those out, get that agreement going. And then there may be things that are specific to particular sectors. So we've got quite an informed discussion about what we can do. Okay, so really that's the structure of this. It's a plenary. It's about, you know, community. We are a community. We are a platform. Let's see people offering those ideas, those thoughts about what we can do together. And I shall start going table to table, or I shall see some hands emerging and see some. And it's always going to slow to start. Who's going to be brave to start? And I shall pick someone over there. Well done. Leadership. Thank you very much. Mao, Green Economy Coalition.
Well, mine is really a challenge that I would like to throw out to the room there. You know, when I told my colleagues that I was heading to London to talk about informality, it's like, London? Talking about informality in London? You know, I think for me the point is, much as how can we work together, really how can we downscale this conversation? Because ultimately we need to be having these conversations at those spaces that matter, in the rooms with those people that actually matter, that play a key role in this sector. So for me, my challenge to the room is, how do we take this conversation back to our regions, to our countries, and so on? And so I'm offering myself up that I would like to downscale this conversation to the Southern African scale. So if anyone wants to work with me in that regard, yeah, you're most welcome to talk to me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mel. Ty.
Thanks. I just wanted to build on that. From CANARI, the Caribbean Natural Resource Institute's perspective, which is working on the ground on green economy and on microenterprise and on the interrelationship, how to create a positive dialectic between them. I think what my colleagues in CANARI are most interested in is, how do you take a conversation that's happening on the ground in one place and network it to conversations that are happening in other parts of the world? How do we learn from one another, but at a grounded level, not at this higher level?
Thank you, Ty. Thank you.
Well, maybe this comment comes because I'm now an academic, but at our table, we spend a lot of time talking about the fact that countries, cities, sectors don't really understand all the roles that everybody plays and where the value addition is and where it isn't and how what are the linkages and how they work together. And so, you know, there are a number of groups that are supporting trying to collect data on this, but I don't think that it's working well enough yet. I guess I would, and maybe we need better, different methodologies of how to think about it. But today we got some little pieces of the puzzle, both by sector and by subnational, that were quite helpful and useful. And maybe more of that analysis would help bring it to the attention of, you know, the various stakeholders.
Thank you, Louise. So bringing things to attention of stakeholders is coming up a lot. Any more comments? Good, thank you.
Thank you. Kate Maher, London School of Economics. One thing that came up quite frequently at our table is the whole issue of terms of inclusion, that we need to think about inclusion of people in public systems, in social welfare systems, in infrastructural extension, but also in the kinds of arrangements that allow them to comply with regulation rather than to simply suspend regulation. So to move beyond this idea that inclusion is inclusion in markets and to think about the ways in which people need to be included in order to comply with regulations that enable sustainability and that enable decent livelihoods.
Thank you very much. Terms of inclusion. Okay. Emily.
So a lot of the conversation at our table was also around the voice and the ability for informal economies to, informal communities to organize themselves. And we talked a bit about that, those safe spaces for that to happen. One thing that comes to my mind is, you know, as part of the Green Economy Coalition, we are working with local partners over the next 3.5 years in a series of 7 different countries, organizing dialogues, really sort of policy dialogues and civil society dialogues, examining what this transition looks like. Obviously, it's for the partners to decide those agendas, but I suspect, and some of the partners are here with us today, that informality is going to be a strong thread in all of those. So perhaps we can commit, as part of the Green Economy Coalition, to ensuring that there is that thread between within all of those dialogues, and then try and connect the dots between those different national conversations. And we would really, I mean, I can just say on behalf of the Secretariat here, would really welcome the expertise in this room to help us do that better, to help us map that better and bring in those communities into the room, because we do have the opportunity, as part of the coalition, to be working with some of those policymakers who are looking at the green growth agenda and shaping that green growth agenda. So we have an opportunity to ensure that the voice of informal communities are part of that discussion. So I hope that we can carry on this conversation in that guise.
Thank you. A contribution of collaboration there. And hi, Richard from TIFA.
Thank you. Yeah, I think listening to the talks today, there were a number of really excellent examples of best practice. And so I think one thing, related to what Emily was just saying, is how are those examples captured and what potential is there for South-South collaboration to foster cooperation in those areas. So, and Peter was talking about this morning 5.5 million enterprises that are now able to bid for government contracts, are able to be enrolled into social security in Brazil. We also heard from Sally about the Colombian experience, how to challenge a government that's threatening the role of waste pickers successfully. We heard from Alex about waste pickers becoming associations and then cooperatives and becoming part of private sector supply chains. So I think there's a number of very good examples of case studies where there are social benefits and environmental benefits often moving together. And there's a question in my mind about how are those examples of best practice, how does that learning carry across to other countries and other contexts?
Thank you, Richard, for sharing. Good.
Hi, I'm Tanya Jennings. I need a job. one of the things that we talked about quite a bit was flipping the pyramid. And instead of looking at the bottom of the pyramid, looking at them as the base and thinking about what they have to teach us, instead of trying to take our unsustainable Western development and try to diffuse it to a billion people, to instead ask them the questions that they've answered in places like Ghana with the ASM. They know what was sustainable. They know what was introduced from the West, developed countries, however you want to look at it, that polluted their environments. And so instead of trying to tell them what green growth looks like, to ask them when their own lives stopped being sustainable and green and how we polluted them. And so it was a very interesting conversation over here, kind of trying to think of how to flip that pyramid and gain some knowledge from a really large group of people who know their land much better than we ever will.
Thank you. And that's a theme that runs through about inclusion and empowerment. So,
thank you. No, we've taken as a given what green growth or inclusive green growth means, and it seems to me that if anything, the conversation today has made me think maybe that is something that we. If we try to define it from the Londons and the Brussels and the Washingtons of the world, we risk actually doing something that has nothing to do with the real world, or that at least does not acknowledge the way the world works. So it seems to me that I'm thinking like concrete things we can do, no? And so I'm thinking one concrete thing we can do is maybe revisit this topic. We're all kind of the converted, but it is not the mainstream to think and to understand and to work on the informal sector. And so maybe we are well connected with OECD and with World Bank, etc. So I think maybe let's push and write the Green Growth and Informality Report, or let's, I know Eva Jaspersson at the UNDP Human Development Report Office. I don't know, let's talk to these people and make something like this happen. That's one area that I think that let's change the meaning of this thing. I'm extending myself, but I promise I'll stop. We talk about green growth or inclusive green growth is the way to, you know, be the triple win, like economic, sustainable, and socially inclusive. But we actually do not know if that's possible. There is not a lot of evidence in the real world whether that can actually happen. I'm not convinced that it can actually exist. And it might be because the definition itself is a bit not based in the reality. So maybe understanding, really, really understanding the informal sector and acquiring information and data on how it actually works might inform these concepts more from a bottom-up way. So maybe that's one way that we could start pushing this thing forward.
So having the conversation not just in London, but in where these issues are most prevalent, making sure people are included, maybe we should come to Peru and we could jointly host that. Maybe we could commit to that straight away, Emily. We do. Okay.
Hi, I'm Mike Bird from WeGo, in the Manchester office of WeGo. I think it's another IIED colleague who was talking about the role of that other private sector, the corporate private sector, and where that has a role. And I'm thinking also of something that one of our board members said. She's a a market vendor from Cotonou in Benin. And I've since discovered she was quoting Gandhi. But what she said, because we talk about doing the analysis, presenting case studies in order to demonstrate how things could change for the better. And that we just need people to understand and they'll wake up to this reality. And she said, it's difficult to wake people up when they're only pretending to be asleep. and the problem is, or one of the problems is, that it's actually the business model of a lot of that corporate private sector that is creating the problem for the working poor. It's they who are choosing to download risk and not to take their responsibilities for social protection seriously. And I just don't think that the CEOs of the FTSE 100 companies are going to wake up tomorrow and think, oh my God, I was wrong. You know, there's a different way of doing it. I think that if that's going to happen, there has to be a constituency for change. And I think that, you know, Marty was talking about organizing. The O in WeGo is about organizing. And the G in WeGo is about globalizing. And we know that capital is globalized. And we're starting to see what that's meaning for the world in terms of the move towards the abyss was how I think Alex talked about it. And we don't want to just move slower towards the abyss. I think we're talking about revaluing and not seeing value just as to be extracted and value to be the dividends that we pay shareholders, but different values and love as a value, for example. I think if we're going to make that kind of change, that kind of structural change, then the sort of constituency that we're talking about has to be globalized. And I think, you know, the liberation theologians of Brazil talked about the option for the poor. And I think it is an option. There is a choice. As Alejandro was saying, we're not sure we can do all of these things. We're not sure we can hit all of these bottom lines. So there is a choice to be made. And I think what I'd like to see is that anyone who's talking about poverty reduction and anyone who's talking about human development had better be seeking out these constituencies of the working poor or the slum dwellers associations or whatever the constituency is, and reaching out to them and working out how we build, we strengthen those organizations. Because unless they're calling from a position of strength for change, I don't think we're going to see it happen.
Thank you. Good. I will charge over.
Thank you. I'm Hubert Schmitz from IDS. I agree very much with what has just been said. But I think if we follow your route, we're making it too difficult. We cannot change the world by bringing everybody to sing from the same sheet, by convincing everybody in the things that we believe. I think it is possible to build coalitions with people and organizations that have completely different objectives, but can be brought to do things that are in our interest. To develop this argument, I think it's very useful to go back to what Kate said earlier on, the need to focus on the terms of inclusion. The terms need to be negotiated. And the chief negotiator, I think that's something that emerged around the room, will have to be, in the first instances, the collective bodies of the informal miners, waste pickers, or whoever we are talking about, you know, associations and cooperatives. We talked a lot about them, perhaps too much. What we did not sufficiently talk about is the alliances they need with others, because on their own, they cannot change things. You know, to bring about change, you need lots of different things. You need money, you need expertise, you need organizational capacity, you need legitimacy, you need leadership. And you know, our waste pickers don't have all of these. They need to work with others who have these. So, you know, who are these allies? you know, these allies can be, the expertise might have to come from the legal profession. And WIGO has lots of examples of working with the legal profession to change things. The alliance can also come from the corporate sector, because the corporate sector is not monolithic. There are parts of the corporate sector that has very interesting business models that, you know, use the circular economy idea. Now, they are not into the circular economy because they're convinced by the green cause, because that is their line of business. They are part of the financial sector that are desperate to, you know, invest in the green economy because they know the writing is on the wall. But, you know, they are not interested in the green economy. They are interested in really good investment opportunities. There are parts of the municipal, many municipal governments that are would love to work with the informal waste pickers, not because they love the informal work waste pickers and are concerned with inclusion or green things, but because they need to deal with the waste. And they know that working with the existing waste companies, they're not making much progress. It's too expensive, it's too slow, it's inefficient. You know, if our waste pickers can show that they can deal with the waste more cheaply, and can have higher recycling rates, and there are examples from around the world where this is achieved, they will be on board. Not because, you know, they, I come back to my argument, not that because they believe in our cause, but because it deals with their, it's a response to their own interest in getting rid of the waste, because this is, you know, part of their performance criteria. So if we look at alliances, which you from the Green Coalition movement, you know, do all the time. If you look at allies and, you know, reach out also to those allies who believe in different things but do things that, you know, can support our cause, that is really the way forward. And it really gives me much more hope. If we just, you know, bank on those that, you know, are the like-minded, the group is too small. It's not powerful enough. We need to reach out, and there are plenty of opportunities.
Thank you, Hubert.
If I can, David Wilson, Imperial College, if I can pick up on that point. The among the Sustainable Development Goals is providing waste collection services to everyone. Our estimate is that between 2 and 3 billion people around the world do not have access to what is a basic utility service underpinning ordinary life. The opportunity to recycle value from waste gives a livelihood opportunity and an income opportunity, which can be used to extend services to unserved neighbourhoods. I work with a fairly new charity, Waste Aid UK. Our first project was in Gambia last year. We were invited in by a local authority who couldn't afford to provide collection services to the poorer neighbourhoods of the municipality. We worked with a local women's charity in Gambia. We set up a recycling training centre, training local women to build micro-enterprises based on what they could actually make and make value from the waste. It included making briquettes from mango leaves and fish meal, because it was on the coast, and paving slabs from
So what are we going to do together, I guess, comes from your example.
What I'm trying to turn the discussion a little bit. We've been talking about, you know, there are 15 to 20 million informal recyclers worldwide. We've been talking about how we help to organise and move forward. We've been linking this to the green economy, and what I'm saying is there is an opportunity here, as the last speaker said, to solve our key problem. We're getting an entry point. You know, why should we be interested? Because we need to solve our waste management problems. And it's actually an opportunity to build, not to help the current informal sector, but to extend the informal sector, to give a livelihood opportunity through the green economy. Actually, green growth is what we're here today to talk about.
Perfect. So we have the Sustainable Development Goals have set us some new development objectives, and we can explicitly talk about the informal sector being a major part of contributing to that particular goal. Thank you very much. We need to make sure that that becomes clearer in the messages of how the big challenges of SDGs will be fed. Alfredo.
Alfredo del Valle from Ceres Center in Chile. Adding to what was just said, I'd like to tell the following. The potential in areas like that, like waste management, urban and so on, is huge, of course. However, how do we actually get that potential manifest in practice? Yeah, and that's the point I want to. The experience from Bogota that was just mentioned is fantastic, but it took long, and it took a fantastic leadership from Bogota's mayor, which is absolutely outstanding and unique. I cannot dream of a mayor like that in my country, in Chile, at all. So it's an exceptional case of somebody who had the leadership and who managed to do that, and many other things he did. Not only that, that was absolutely, I wish we had repetition, not only one mayor, several mayors in a row. Yeah. So, but that, sorry, is exceptional. It's not the rule. Yeah. And I think the what we need to find is how to manage, how to learn to manage those extremely complex cases. Just to mention my city, Santiago, 35 municipalities make up Santiago. No mayor, or whatever the name of the whole. Yeah. And so simply we don't have the political capacity there to do something like that. What we do have is, of course, some of them are get together and do and have a company that does the typical thing. Yeah. But so rounding up, I think we have a tremendous challenge that has to do with governance of these extremely complex questions. Yeah. The potential, technically speaking, is fantastic, is clear, can be identified. But unless we learn how to manage these extremely complex things and we exchange experiences on that management beyond exceptional cases, and unfortunately, and I have to say fortunately for the Bogotanians, but unfortunately for the rest of the world, yeah, this is an exceptional case.
Thank you, Alfredo. Yeah, I work with Alfredo, and one of the really fascinating things that I've learned from him is this sense of it's prevalent in the sustainability community. We're always looking for that silver bullet, which what is the answer? You know, and I guess one of the challenges that I bring to the opportunities you bring to this group, even in this session, is there's a sort of sense of is my idea of what we should do right or wrong? Or should I be brave enough to contribute it or not? Will it form part of the consensus or not? You know, and that doesn't matter. What matters is this is immensely complex. We will probably need a challenge on the private sector, how it works. We will probably need a greater drive on the different value proposition. We will probably need better support of the local communities and the ability to establish themselves and to create the dialogues. We'll need it in country. We will need all of these ideas. Absolutely all of them. And probably many, many more. So I encourage you to say not only what we need, but how that works together. How that becomes part of a movement that really tackles the complexity and addresses the complexity and isn't scared of it.
Yes, I think I'm Kate Maher again from the LSE. I think we need to introduce a little bit more politics into our concept of the we when we say what are we going to do together. In North America, we have an expression, what do you mean we, white men? when we talk about what we're going to do together, I think Hubert Schmitz raised an important point about alliances, and WIGO is also very strong about alliances. But there is a difference between coalitions and alliances. If you take associations of small-scale informal operators and put them up against corporations, that is not an equal negotiating relationship. And WIGO has made it very clear that such relationships require coalitions of informal actors to link up with labor unions or to link up with supportive national or municipal representatives. It's very important to see what we're going to do together in ways that create alliances of informal operators with like-minded supportive organizations in order to equalize their power relationships to negotiate with perhaps more self-interested financial systems, private corporations, states, and other actors. So I think we need to be very sensitive about the kinds of power relations we're talking about when we talk about the informal economy, who are, by definition, for the most part, very vulnerable individuals, even when they form associations.
Thank you. So, Camilla.
Well, very much following on from Kate's point, I think it's really important to look at this within the context of where power lies and how a whole variety of different tools are used to disempower or to belittle different actors. And I'd like us to go back to, I think, one of the first things that Marty was raising, which was around the sort of myths and the narratives that surround much of the informal sector, and the need to find a language. I liked your people's private sector, to find a language which is very upbeat, that recognises the huge value of a mosaic economy, which is lots and lots of different shapes, sizes, scales, colours, and which helps the powers that be understand that actually that's a real strength. Well, it's a real strength for the political classes if their power relies on having a large number of ordinary people's votes behind them. Of course, it often doesn't, which is part of the problem. But that kind of finding words to describe that bottom-up, locally based, highly diverse, you know, innovative and, wonderful diversity which gives strength to the overall economic ecosystem, just as biological diversity does to the ecological system. So let's think also if we can do a little bit of word crafting, redesigning some of the ways in which we talk about... I mean, why do we talk about informal? It sounds as though the problem is that it's not formal then. So it's a kind of negative of the formal. So let's do a bit of work on crafting that new narrative.
Thank you, Camilla. Hand over here.
I'm Joanna Kitchen from Middlesex Uni. As students, so some of the things I might say may be quite naive, really. From what I've picked up today, it seems like from a lot of the discussions for informal economies, it seems as if their key motivation in terms of taking part of that side of economy is more for survival and self-sufficiency for the day-to-day kind of thing. And I was thinking, if we were to really recognize informal economies and acknowledge them and, you know, go through the whole process of inclusion, probably it's better to encourage them towards a more dynamic kind of process of, you know, kind of lifting them out of poverty as opposed to seeing them as the informal economy trying to just sustain themselves. So, you know, this may be by way of, I don't know, educating them and actually empowering them that they can move beyond where they are. And that might be part of revaluing their position on this kind of really diverse value chain, like where they stand and, you know, how kind of reassessing their worth on what they provide to the economy as a whole.
Joanna. Thank you, Joanna. Okay. Carol.
Hello, I'm Carol Gripner from Hivos, Netherlands. And I would like to build on what you were saying, Camilla, on the need for reframing. I sometimes wonder why we talk about inclusive green economies as if economy is the final goal. Well, I think that economies are there to serve people and to ensure that our natural resources, our planet is being sustained, you could say. So it's like, are we not using the terminology that in a way is working against what we actually want? Building on that also is the idea like informal, formal, as if these are two very big extremes. Well, I really like that idea of the hybrid economy, that there's just really a diversity of different economic models that mutually can strengthen one another, that might also work against one another, but to avoid the trap of assuming that informality is now the solution for everything and not formality, to get away from those really polarized debates, I would say. Thirdly, what I really appreciated today was like making things visible. I think all the presentations showed really the power of what's already happening on the ground in the informal sector. And that also for me and my organization, Hivos, this is really one of the things we feel is really very much needed, that we talk about very complex problems, but many people around the world are working on solutions and they're doing it in their daily lives. And I think it's really making that richness which is out there visible, for me, is like one of the big challenges all of us could be working on. And then, yeah, create spaces where people can start working around these complex problems, not immediately looking for the single silver bullet, but trying to understand what's happening and working gradually towards different paths of solutions. I think it's really creating those spaces for experimentation, for getting to understand different perspectives and gradually work towards maybe a new system. So that's it.
Thank you. Paul.
I mean, I just want to observe what I've noticed is what seems to be a slight tension in the discussion in the room and in the interesting sectoral discussions we've had. I mean, we seem to be able to conclude that the informal sector is big and important, but as to how long it should exist, there seems to be quite divergent views coming across. I mean, it seems that some people are saying it's a transition and it's about how to effectively formalize it and move it into the formal economy, whereas others seem to be saying it has inherent advantages and should continue indefinitely with the formal economy. And it seems unless we can resolve that fairly fundamental question, we're not going to be able to work out how to proceed, unless it varies from sector to sector. Maybe mining sector, it's different from the agriculture sector. So I just think it would be good to get clarity on that fundamental question.
Louise, are you going to address that?
I'm going to make an attempt. So a number of people, I've been at various forums where people said we should just ban the word informal, et cetera, et cetera. It won't go away. Sorry, but it won't go away. So we're stuck with it. But I think we need to think about it as a continuum. It's not a 0-1 proposition. I think people mean different things by formalization as well. And that also may not be a 0-1 proposition, but a continuum. And I think there are some other views expressed today. I don't think talking about whether something is good or bad, to me it's like asking whether the sun or the moon is good or bad. It's there, you know. And I don't think it's really helpful so much to put so much of a normative view on something that's there. We're all in the business in various ways of trying to make people's lives better. And I think making people who work in some continuum of this sector's lives better is really our goal. And we don't, and some sectors it may be pursued in one way, in some sectors another way. you know, but I think we just need to agree we share the goal, and then we're okay. We can just move if we can.
Thank you.
Two comments, because we deal with these questions and issues all the time. On the term informal economy, we consider it a second best term. And as long as all the models and the paradigms and the resources and all of that are geared towards what is called the formal economy, we feel it's important to have an aggregate concept that can be measured so we can say what share of workers' units' output are informal and that we need to change the paradigm. So we have another inverted pyramid. We keep the original pyramid, the big base, and then we have an inverted pyramid which says all the resources and the paradigms and the models are directed at the tip and not at the bottom. And the goal is to make that equal. That is the founding graphic of the WeGo network 20 years ago, right? On whether the informal is good or it's bad, I agree that's where the people are working. And what happened in the ILO debate on the informal economy in 2002 was that people were saying, are you promoting the informal economy? What are you promoting? What are you? And there was a very brilliant Malaysian economist, Lin Lim, at the ILO, who framed it in terms of the decent work agenda of the ILO, which has four pillars: opportunities, right, protection, and voice. And she framed it as, on average, the informal workforce has greater deficits of decent work than formal workers. And what we're trying to do is reduce the decent work deficit. So it's not that we're saying informality is great as it is. We're saying it is the majority of the reality. And we need to work to make all of those pillars better for the informal workers. So it's not glamorizing or romanticizing informality, just saying, folks, this is the majority of workforce units, maybe not output. I mean, output, it's probably in most countries, of, you know, 45, 50%. But in terms of workers and units, it's the majority. And so, and then just finally on formalization, we just go back and forth. Having a permit, folks, is not formalization. It is in the very sort of legal, illegal sense. But we had a test case of a street vendor in Durban who had had a permit for 16 years. He sold sandals. He was the sole breadwinner for a 9-member family. He was an activist. He was a member of 2 street vendor associations that were in constant negotiation with the city. One day, he leaves his stall to go to one of those meetings. He hands his permit to his assistant. His assistant at lunchtime hands the permit to the next vendor and says, I'm just going to get my lunch. I'll be right back. As soon as he steps away, a woman, policewoman, comes in, takes all the fresh stock, 20 pairs of sandals that weren't bleached, puts them in a bag, leaves this receipt that says one bag of goods, not itemized, warrant and fine. He went to pay the fine, collect his confiscated goods. They said, we don't know where they are. And a legal case was fought and won for him. So having that permit, folks, doesn't formalize you. It doesn't.
I want to abuse my position as because I think that one of the advantages of bringing different concepts and different groups together is that there are ways to reevaluate. And I just want to bring the concept of good and bad here. The Green Economy Coalition came about because we did not believe the plane was heading in the right direction, that it was creating too much mess and it didn't have enough people on board. You know, the plane of the old economy, the brown economy, was unfair and it was degrading our environment. We wanted a new economy, an economy that creates prosperity, decent livelihoods for all. So when I asked myself the dilemma of do I want to formalize to something which is a plane that is crashing, no, I don't. I want to create a new economy which creates better opportunities, better livelihoods for everybody, and that doesn't destroy the environment. So we have an opportunity with the new economy thinking to start to say, how does this create better livelihoods? And to remove these concepts of formal, informal, about livelihoods for people in this new economy. That's the opportunity we have today, allowing us to create these two concepts together and see the new movement and the new opportunity to redefine what it is to live and work in those that emerging economy. Anyway, that was my abusing my position. Bill.
We have about 12 minutes left before we go to the summary. We've had some... This is Bill Vorley, by the way, of IID. Excuse me. We have... some ideas, very good discussion, some ideas presented on whether we have something here, despite how we approach the word we, let's just say the people we here, is there something here greater than the sum of its parts that wants to work together on some of these issues? I really want us to make sure that we have at least aired that opportunity before we close. We've had a couple some ideas, like the informality and green growth report, which is a and this idea of exposure and data, which is also really important. But do we have something here that we can leave as an agreement for collaboration, or do we just meet in a year and revisit this?
Bill, you were part of bringing us together, so maybe you should also answer that question. Okay. We have a number of people that brought us together. Would you like to have a go at what you might think we might do together?
Yes. Maybe I want to get back to the discussion before I answer this question, if I'm. Okay, I think what came out for me is like, you know, having a regional focus and a thematic focus. I really liked hearing from different sectors, from different regions, and how similar logics and solutions appear and sometimes how different it is. At the same time, I noticed that we all said, so I was saying the food economy is the biggest informal sector. And then I heard the artisanal small-scale mining is the biggest informal sector, and then the non-farm rural sector, yes, and also the waste collection. And you know, I'm not having any opinions on that, but this is where I join Alejandro. Maybe, and especially coming from a policy-oriented institution, I think there is a need to get our narrative right, because if we, you know, it's like focusing really on what a policymaker might take away from our collective knowledge and what are the key messages would be important. Thank you.
Thank you, Philip. Okay, so we're really focusing on what we can do together.
Marguerite. Let me be very practitioner and practical. Early on, someone said to me, where is the private sector? Is there any private sector in the room? And someone is mentioning mayors. I really felt appealed by that idea because they're very much on the ground, but I don't think they're in the room. And one of the things we could do together is when next we meet, each one of us, I'm sure we all have these networks of mayors and private sectors and, I don't know, high-level government people who hate talking about informality, that all of us together for the next conference, we try to forge a coalition of the unwilling and see if we can make them willing.
Thank you, Marguerite. Oh, Ben.
Thank you. Just to build on that idea, my name is Ben Simmons. I'm with the Green Growth Knowledge Platform. And for those of you that don't know what that is, it's a initiative that was founded by the World Bank, the OECD, the Global Green Growth Institute, and UNEP several years ago before RioPlus20. And it's now a partnership of 44 institutions, all focused on green growth and green economy. I want to thank you and the organizers for this workshop. It's been very interesting. I don't think the green growth, green economy voice has been as strong as the sort of social inclusion and informal economy voice in the room. I think in order to move forward, that would be one area we could think about strengthening. From my perspective, in terms of what I think GGKP could bring to this group, we have an annual conference that's being convened at the beginning of September in Jeju, the Republic of the Korea. The focus will be on inclusiveness. Certainly, we can focus at least one of those sessions on the informal economy. That's something that we could do. That conference brings together the leading researchers and institutions focused on advocating for a green economy, green growth transition. The second thing that we certainly could do is to include informal economy within our research program and also our knowledge management program. We draw together most of the analysis and data that currently exists on green growth, green economy. We currently do not track any literature related to informal economy. We have around 1,300 studies that we currently collect. So that's something very pragmatic that we can do to start drawing attention to that community of the importance of this issue. One thing I would like to do, but that we're not able to do, is to provide a data point. And I think that was a discussion that we started to have. We currently have 193 country pages where we track each country's transition to a green economy across 20 data points for 50 years. So that's a lot of data, but nothing focused on informal economy. And so I think that would be a challenge that I would like to provide this group to say, is there a data point that we should be tracking so we understand that relationship?
You're sitting next to Peter Poshin from the ILO, so we hopefully that... Thank you, Ben, very much. And actually, you know, the point about the data, I mean, I look at all those presentations today, and you know, the world experts on these issues are in this room and have created synthesized presentations full of data points. You know, it's not beyond us to synthesize that in one way and actually have a really good start on some of that story. And all those presentations, by the way, will be available online, and we will send you the URL, and that conversation can continue. Sheila.
I'm Xue Wen from IIED. This might be a crazy idea, but I'm putting it out there. Just like we're all used to DFID's gender mainstreaming. You probably know how it feels like to fill that box on the proposal or on reporting. So I'm just putting out there, what if we advocated for informality mainstreaming in all the financing going to green growth or all the other donor-funded projects?
Great. There's an advocacy challenge. Okay. Okay, so we are drawing close to Steve's attempt to synthesize, but, you know, I mean, if... It's always the most difficult bit, this, because it's always that sense of what can we do together, and yet a lot of people know each other, but part of the relationships that are required to build working relationships is trust and knowing each other for a long time, and this community coming together more than once, and just an expectation that these things take time. And the coalition probably started in 2009. It was really till 2011-12 till it really felt the need, and also what it needed was an external moment which we had to respond to. So Rio came along and Green Economy came along. How about there is a, and Ben has posed this challenge, in September there is a green growth meeting of the great in Korea. You know, maybe that is a moment where we can target to articulate what does informality look like. It's an external opportunity. Maybe that's something that we could really talk to about. The fact that we've created so much knowledge in preparation of this meeting is an opportunity for us to synthesize it, the report. The fact that this conversation needs to happen not just here, but in all of the countries where this is most relevant. We offer that. We would be delighted to work, and IID delighted to working in country to make these conversations come alive. Our separate platforms that we have, we heard from Margaret, the fact that these platforms need to be coming together, seeing not green economy as a risk, but as an opportunity. And we did do a little bit of a stat beforehand whether or not the green growth was an opportunity or a threat to informality. 71% was opportunity, 29%. And I think that's fair enough. The point is for us is it's definitely a threat unless we're in there determining the rights or the mandate for people. Unless we're there, it won't be as good as we want it to be.